It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As Wisconsinites feel the effects of core inflation and the loss of purchasing power, we turn to a personal finance author for tips on handling money, paying down debt, and budgeting. Call in with a question. Share your experiences about money at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Erin Lowry writes the Broke Millennial Personal Finance book series. Her new one is a workbook. It's called Take Control and Get Your Financial Life Together. Erin, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Hi, wonderful to be back.
Okay, we start with stress. There's this recent Associated Press NORC poll estimating more than a third of American adults are stressed about personal finances. And you are telling us we should start re-examining our budgeting by first re-examining our relationships with money. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, I think so often we are under this belief that, you know, I'm not good at math, so I'm not good at money, or, oh, you know, this is just not something that my brain does well. And to be honest, so much of money is actually more about psychology than anything else. We are really not rational beings when it comes to handling our money. And so part of how we spend, save, and invest, or lack thereof, is really tied to our emotional relationship with money. So we have to do a better job of examining the how and why we emotionally react the way that we do with money. And some of the really easy ways to consider this is reflect on, how does money make you feel? I know that's kind of a broad question, but truly, when I say, all right, think about money, what is your body's emotional reaction to that? And that gives you a lot of information.
Hmm. And you also want us to think, you know, about the question, what would you do with surprise money? What are some of the questions that we could consider to figure out, you know, what our psychological relationship, what our, you know, mental relationship is, our attitude is with money?
Well, some of the early things that you can try to answer for yourself is, what is your first memory of money? How does it make you feel? Now, not to be blaming the parents out there or to give people an out to get to blame their parents, but we tend to be actually coding our relationship with money between the ages of about 7 and 12. So at that phase of your life, how were people talking about money? Were you told that it was taboo and polite, not something that you talk about? How was money discussed in your house, if it was at all? Did it cause fights? Was it just sort of a neutral? Was it a positive? Was there a period at all in your life where something really dramatic or catastrophic happened around money? Did your family lose their home? Did somebody have to file bankruptcy? Did somebody lose a job and then that created a stressful situation? Or has that personally happened to you in adulthood? Or also thinking about things like, if you were to lose your job, what is the immediate aftermath of that? And are you in a position to be able to go along, get along for a little while? Do you have enough in savings? Do you have enough of an emergency support system outside of just finances? Or is that going to be immediately the bottom falls out and that causes a lot of anxiety? I feel like we're coming in very hot and stressful first thing in the morning talking about money. But, you know, these are actually some of the questions early on that we can start to be asking ourselves to try to figure out, how do I relate to money? And the other big thing I would consider, when you are just experiencing stress at all, it doesn't have to be related to money, but if you're in a stressful situation, what is your knee-jerk reaction to that? Is it to go buy something? Because then you get that dopamine rush and it makes you feel good. Because that could also be a trigger situation worth examining. And maybe part of the overspending that's happening has very little to do with money and a lot to do with just how you personally respond to stress.
Bit of that retail therapy. You have this intense scarcity mindset around money. Can you talk a little bit about your relationship with money?
So I think what's really important to consider is that, you know, like I said, we often will be like, oh, well, how was your childhood when it comes to talking about a lot of this? And sometimes even parts of how you grew up doesn't necessarily match maybe what you are embodying as an adult, in the sense that I grew up in an environment where money was basically a neutral. My parents talked about it. They talked about it fairly openly and honestly. There wasn't a whole lot of emotional stress assigned to it. There was never a time where there was a lot of concern about bills getting paid. But because there was also a model of frugality that got modeled for me, even as an adult, there is always this kind of voice in the back of my head saying, this could all go away tomorrow, which as somebody who is self-employed and an entrepreneur and therefore doesn't earn a steady paycheck, that can be incredibly stressful. So there is just this sort of inner voice that always thinks, oh, something could go away. Now, there are a lot of positives to that mindset. The positives being I tend to be a big saver. I also, fortunately for me, it does manifest in terms of investing. For some people, they would be too worried about investing. They would exclusively save. But I'm a stronger saver. I don't spend a ton. But on the flip side, it can sometimes mean saying yes to absolutely everything as opposed to being a bit more discerning about deciding, oh, this is truly, you know, a job that I want to take on, or this makes sense for growing my company. So it is really important for people to evaluate their scarcity versus, we also call it, abundance mindset. Do you worry that everything is just going to go away tomorrow? And how does that make you behave in the present?
We're getting advice for saving money, paying off debt. Erin Lowry with us, author of The Broke Millennial Workbook. You can join in with your questions and your comments at 800-642-1234. Erin, your workbook explores financial self-sabotage. What are some of the most common ways people self-sabotage their financial situations?
One really classic one, and again, tying back to this idea of how you grew up, but how you grew up is normal to you, and it's also a comfort zone for you. And interestingly, I have a friend of mine who grew up with a lot of financial chaos. There was just not a whole lot of financial stability in her house growing up. So even as an adult into her 40s, that to her is what is ultimately comfortable. So anytime she ends up putting herself in a strong financial situation, be that she's boosted her emergency savings fund, she feels, you know, everything is kind of copacetic. She's able to pay all of her bills. Her savings is going well. There's something in her brain that makes her just feel like, oh, that's too much. And she will do something to put herself in a bit of financial chaos, whether that's book a trip that's too expensive, which means she has to pillage her emergency savings fund, or end up making a big purchase for her home. Same sort of consequence. Because ultimately, she's trying to return to what she knows and understands, which is financial chaos as opposed to financial stability. And if you don't identify the why and start to work on that, you're going to probably keep engaging in the same behaviors over and over and over and feeling like, well, I'm just not good with money. It's a me problem. I just can't get good with money. Which is entirely untrue, but a big part of it is identifying psychologically why you're doing the things you're doing and not just making it be like, well, this set of rules say that I have to save like this and pay off debt like this, and I just have to be super rigid. And then once I achieve this goal, I'll be good and I'll be set. You're not going to be set unless you identify your triggers and your whys.
The author of the Broke Millennial series, personal finance help from Erin Lowry, our guide to paying down debt, creating a spending plan, strategies for managing money in tight economic times. You can be part of this conversation about money at any point. Drop us a line, call in with a question, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. With Wisconsin's unemployment rate hovering near record lows, we get personal finance tips for how to make paychecks stretch further. Call in with a money management question. Share your perspective at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Erin Lowry is author of the Broke Millennial Personal Finance Book Series, and her latest one is a workbook. Let's bring in Jake in Milwaukee. Jake, hi. What is your perspective?
Hi there. I guess just like with it being reported that over 50% of American adults are living paycheck to paycheck, we just hit $1 trillion in credit card debt in this country. It doesn't seem like people are going to be able to save their way out of poverty. I guess I just really wish I would hear one of these personal finance experts give the advice of organizing your coworkers into unions and not saving more of your paycheck, but growing it to the point where it should have been in the first place.
Jake, thank you so much for that perspective. Aaron, you know, what if all the careful budgeting and frugality is not enough?
Oh, he's absolutely right. It's not. You know, I would say too, and I write about this a lot in my work, we do have to recognize systems and that this bootstrap narrative is wrong. You know, we have been sort of fed a fallacy to a degree about how, oh, you can just scrimp and save your way to things. And maybe for previous generations, there was an element of that that was true, but we are facing so many records these days, whether it is record high credit card debt, student loan debt, cost of just living in general, and across the board wage stagnation. Now, while I agree with if you work in a job where the unionizing element could be helpful, unfortunately, even that's not true for absolutely everyone. And so I do feel, and it's a big part of my third book and Broke Millennial Workbook, that you also have to really learn the skill set of negotiating. And I hate to put the onus again on the individual, but in addition to just thinking through if you do not work in a job environment where a union is an option for you and therefore collective bargaining is an option, you have to learn how to effectively negotiate within your job or with job hopping and going to a new job or reskilling and retraining, which it is incredibly frustrating. I acknowledge that this still feels like it's all on the individual. But I guess my reframe on that would be, if we still feel like maybe a bit disenfranchised and we individually don't have the power, what little bits of things can we do to try to take power back? And a big part of that is just learning how to push back and negotiate to increase your paycheck, at least enough to make it keep up with inflation, which we all know is just killing absolutely everyone, no matter where we live right now.
How do you go about asking coworkers about their salary or to know if you are being paid on par with a peer?
I love this question because so often people really don't want to talk to their coworkers about how much they're making, or you might work in an environment where it feels unsafe to do so. So I'm going to kind of come at this from two different angles. If you work in a space where it feels like you can safely ask your coworkers, how much do you make? You have a few different options about how to go about that. One is that direct, blunt question. Hey, I was just curious, how much are you earning? Now, a lot of people might feel either A, uncomfortable asking that, or B, that they think the receiver is going to be uncomfortable answering. So one of the most strategic ways you can do this, give a reason. Hey, I'm going in for a negotiation next week. I just want to talk about my salary. And actually, it would be really helpful for me to get a sense of how much you're earning, because we do the same job, we work with the same clients, you know, insert reason why here. So could you tell me, do you make over or under, and then insert your salary question. So could you tell me, do you make over or under $45,000? Do you make over or under $50,000? And if they say over, keep asking, keep pushing up the number until you get a really good sense of what the ballpark is that they're making. Or maybe they'll turn around and say to you, oh, no problem. Yeah, I make $62,000. They might answer you directly. It's also incredibly important for people who are self-employed, entrepreneurial in any way, to also be asking people in their cohort who do similar things that they do these questions. And I say that as somebody who one time did a job.
I was hoping you would go there. Go there.
Yeah,
yes.
I asked a friend of mine. And it was if like every possible factor was controlled for. We are both women. We are pretty much in the exact same age bracket. We both live in the same city. We were going to the same job to perform the same task. And I, you know, I had a little liquid courage, I'll be honest. And I finally said, do you mind me asking how much you got paid for this gig? And she said, oh yeah, I got paid 10,000. Well, I got paid three. So we were at a $7,000 difference for the exact same amount of work. And a big part of it is I just didn't understand what the market would bear for that kind of work. I had no sense. So when I got asked, how much do you charge? I said a number that seemed reasonable to me. And if I had never asked her that question, I would have continued to A, undercharge, and B, had no idea how much other people were making. That was a $7,000 difference. That's huge. And I do the kind of work that's variable income, feast or famine. So you want to make a good amount of money on a specialized skill set when you can, because you don't know when your next big paycheck is coming. So it is really important, no matter the kind of job you do, that we're having these conversations. The other big part of this, if you're working a job, or again, if you're self-employed and maybe you don't live near anybody or you don't know anybody personally that does the kind of work that you do, or you're in an office environment or work environment where you feel uncomfortable asking coworkers, yes, there's like Glassdoor and salary.com and all of these quote unquote transparency pay tools, but they're not as effective as directly asking someone. So the other thing you can do is cold pitch people on sources like a LinkedIn. And look for people, control for as much as you can. Someone who lives generally in the same area that you do, working for the same size company that you are, doing, very similar work as you, and reach out with the same kind of question. Hi, I'm getting ready to go in for a job interview or to negotiate on my salary. And I'm just getting the sense that I might be underpaid in our industry. Could you tell me, do you make over or under X amount of money? And I know it might sound wild to cold pitch people about this, but you would be surprised how many people are willing to help someone else out in their industry. And the other thing, if you ever get cold pitched like that, the way I always like to think about it is think about this as sort of collective bargaining. If we can get other people to get paid more, it's not less for everyone. We are raising the bottom rate for everyone. So we are lifting, rising tide lifts all boats kind of idea. So it is very important to share this information with each other.
We're getting advice for saving money, paying off debt, and handling money. Erin Lowry, author of The Broke Millennial Workbook, you can call in with your questions and your experiences, concerns, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Erin, you've brought up self-employment here sometimes, and I just had such an aha moment in your workbook. You encourage self-employed adults to pay themselves a fixed monthly salary. Can you just talk about that tip for a moment?
Absolutely. If you structure your business certain ways, for example, as an S corporation, you're paying yourself a set monthly salary. You have to run a payroll. But a lot of us don't. That's not how a lot of people structure their business, especially in the early years. So one thing that I found very effective for myself was that I, first of all, you should open a business checking account. Like, have a business bank account. That's where all of your money goes. It should be kept separate from your personal money. So once I started doing that and I had all of my money getting routed into a business checking account, I was starting to notice the trends. Just for most people, to a degree, work can be seasonal. There can be certain times of the year where you earn more than others. For me, summer is always a slow season. And I realized that if I already have that information and if I know that, and I know that certain times of the year I'm just going to make huge chunks of my annual salary as opposed to making a steady amount all year. Well, if I leave it to accumulate in my business checking account and just pay myself a steady salary, one, that makes it easier for my personal life to be able to budget. And two, it really takes a lot of the stress off of the booms and bust cycles that can be entrepreneurship. So I started setting out first. I like to create what I call a bare essential budget. So I know exactly the bare minimum that I need in a month, basically to survive. Paying rent, keeping utilities on, paying deductibles on insurance, all of that kind of stuff, just the bare amount that I need every month. So I look at what that number is, and then, if I'm not in a stressful time, I'll pay myself more so that I can live a lifestyle more accustomed to what I would like to be living and get to do some fun things. But if it's in a season of my life and my business where I need to tighten it up, I'll pay myself the bare essential budget. But the point is that I just pay myself a steady salary out of my business checking account. And I did really start to figure out that thanks to sort of the boon times, if you do that, you usually will not get into a situation where, oh my gosh, I lived it up large for 3 months because I was making good money. And now all of a sudden I'm not making good money and I have to scramble. And this is so stressful.
Oh,
And it also
so
just.
it really gets rid of kind of that yo-yo effect for income.
Absolutely. Gets rid of the yo-yo and makes it so that you can also stabilize how much you feel like you can save and invest out of
Ah.
your paycheck, which is huge.
We have personal finance author Erin Lowry here with strategies for saving, paying down debt. We're going to get tips more from her latest Broke Millennial Workbook. As we discuss money management, call in with a question, share your concerns, at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org and explore your money situation with Aaron. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Wisconsin's labor force is growing. We learned strategies to avoid living paycheck to paycheck. Personal finance author from the Broke Millennial series, Aaron Lowry, is here. And you can discuss a money situation with Aaron at any point in the conversation. Call in with a question or comment at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Ted in Merrill is here. Hi, Ted. What is your money question?
Well, I work in the medical profession, and adjusted for inflation, I make less now per hour than I did 25 years ago when I got out of school. And so the question that I have is, so many kids are trying to figure out what path to go down that is going to be lucrative versus what the input is for student loans and that type of thing. So I guess my question is there any database that is honest about what is forecasting for kids as far as income once they have the years of school that they go into, that's going to really give them a benefit versus coming out with so much debt? And then
salary not keeping up with inflation, you know, 25 years later. Aaron, do you have insights?
I do. You know, interestingly enough, the other factor I would add on top of this is the rise of artificial intelligence and the impact that that's going to have on certain professions. And one resource that it might be a little wonky and technical to hear is actually the U.S. Bureau of Labor and Statistics has an occupational handbook online. Is it going to be the prettiest thing you've ever seen? It is not. But the thing that's really interesting about that is there's a whole bunch of different ways you can filter, including jobs that are predicted to have the largest influx of need in the coming years. So looking at jobs that actually are going to be high demand, as opposed to jobs that are maybe leveling off or even going to decrease in demand. Now, I'll be honest, I feel like some of the stats are a little bit delayed by about maybe 6 months to a year. But the other part here too, and you really touched on this point with the amount that it takes years not only to get licensed in certain fields, the amount it can cost in student loans, you know, how many doctors are in hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt. So the other thought as well is, I hope that we start to see more of a rise in looking at either vocational, occupational, or trade schools in addition to looking at four-year institutions or associate's degrees, because one, again, the rise of artificial intelligence, this is probably going to be an industrial revolution that really impacts the knowledge worker and the quote unquote white collar worker in a different way than we've ever seen before. So what are jobs that have much lower upfront costs, but are actually going to have much higher job protection in the coming years for that younger Gen Z and then the upcoming Gen Alpha?
Looking at those student loans, in October, the federal government is set to resume requiring payments for federal student loans. And according to the U.S. Department of Education, Wisconsin's roughly 740,000 borrowers hold roughly $24 billion in federal student loan debt. What should borrowers do now to prepare for repayment?
One of the first things that you need to do is log in to all of the various resources that you have to see what your payment is going to be and just double check who owns it. You know, as we've seen, there is a lot of change that happens in terms of student loan ownership because companies sell off or fold or stop supporting student loans. Navient a few years back being a really famous one. So make sure that you actually know who the companies are that own your student loans. Make sure you can log into the FAFSA websites, as well as just going into any sort of the government-backed student loan websites. But in addition, if you have private student loans, pulling your credit report is a really good way to just double check, oh, this is all of the different places that I have to pay student loans. Now, you've probably been paying on your private student loans this whole time. They did not pause in the same way as federal. So first, collect the information, make sure you know everything. The other part, you still have a little bit of breathing room before those payments start. So one thing that I would really strongly recommend is kind of doing a what if budget already, except you know the what if is coming. And what I mean by that is start acting as if you are making that payment. So let's say hypothetically that you pay $300 a month towards your student loans. You haven't had to do it for the past 3 years. So that's $300 that have been going to other things. Well, let's rework your budget so that you're going to behave this month like, okay, that $300 has to go to student loans. Maybe you put it into savings. Maybe you put it towards that very first student loan payment. You just set it aside. So maybe you make a $600 payment on that first payment. Whatever it is that you want to do, but actually simulate and run a budget as if you're already making that payment so that you can feel its impact and what it's going to mean for the rest of your financial life. That's actually a system that I love using no matter what the big life change is coming up. Maybe you're going to move soon and your rent is going to be higher. Maybe you're going to have a kid and you're going to have to start paying for daycare. Whatever it is, starting to actually act early on as if you've already made that adjustment in your monthly budget, and then putting that money aside, and then you can kind of save it up to put towards the big life change that's coming.
What you talk about there makes me think about lifestyle inflation, like, you know, getting a raise or not really seeing any change in your financial circumstances. How do you avoid that lifestyle inflation?
I do want to push back a little bit on the very common personal finance rhetoric of like, never increase your lifestyle. There are certain phases of life where you absolutely should increase your lifestyle as your life changes. The version of myself that was 22 and earning very little money living in New York City is very different than my 34-year-old self. And it is okay for my 34-year-old self to spend more money as I've earned more money. So you don't have to always be in this deprivation mentality is the first way that I'm going to say it. Now, that being said, you don't want to every time you see an increase level up to match it, in the sense that, yeah, sometimes, especially what if you're already living a lifestyle that you really enjoy and that you love and you feel like brings a lot of value and you don't feel like you are scrimping and saving and trying to just get through every month. If you are living a lifestyle that you enjoy, and your boss calls you in and says, hey, we're giving you a 10% raise this year. Well, okay, that's an example where maybe that 10% automatically goes towards your 401k, or partly towards your 401k and partly towards your savings account, in a way that you didn't quote unquote need it to live a nice lifestyle that you wanted, but you're going to set up future you. One of the easiest ways to combat lifestyle inflation, if you're trying to avoid it, is to just basically act as if the money never existed in the first place by routing it automatically towards a retirement account or a savings account, so it never even hits your checking account.
A savings account that is in a separate place, as you say, not in the, perhaps not with the same banking institution where your checking account is. That makes it too easy to kind of slosh money back and forth.
I am a big fan of having your savings account be at a completely different bank than your day-to-day checking account, if that feels safe for you. You know, maybe you want to have a little bit of a buffer at the same bank as your day-to-day checking, but the big emergency savings, first of all, that better be at a bank that is giving you a decent interest rates. That is the only perk we have seen in inflation, is that a lot of the banks, especially the online internet-only banks, are just skyrocketing their interest rates.
4.3%. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. So if you're at a bank where you're getting 0.01%, 0.05%, 0.1%, listen, if a zero is in front of a decimal point where you bank in terms of your savings, APY, annual percent yield, please switch your banks. Please put most of your money in a place where you're actually getting a good return. Will it make you rich? Probably not. But hey, it could be the difference of like a couple extra $100, depending on how much you have in savings by the end of the year. And that's an easy way to, I don't know, save up for Christmas. There's your Christmas budget right there.
Erin Lowry with us as we talk about saving, investing, paying down debt, author of The Broke Millennial Workbook. You can join in with your money situation, call in with a question or a concern at 800-642-1234. Okay, Erin, it's going to sound a bit like winter here because you're going to talk about snowball versus avalanche in paying down debt and what to do first. Can you talk a little bit about what sets these two methods apart?
Yeah, so there's two main strategies that people love to talk about when it comes to debt payoff. There's the snowball, debt avalanche. I'll be honest, just hearing it is a little hard sometimes compared to actually looking at the numbers on a screen. So feel free to Google this later. But basically, what you want to focus on, I like to say that debt snowball is that it makes your brain happy version, and the debt avalanche is the numbers just save you more money in the long run. Which one is right? It doesn't matter. Whichever one works for you. Now, here's how it brief overview of how they break down. With debt snowball, you're going to list out all of your debts. You're going to look at who has them, what kind of debt it is, and then what is your minimum monthly due every single month. And then next to that, I want you to write in a column, what is the principal balance you owe? Now, to be honest, we are not really that focused at all on interest rates. So you don't even have to bother writing them down. But what you want to focus on is reordering those debts so that the smallest balance that you owe, not the minimum payment, the overall principal balance, we're going to focus on that debt first. So hypothetically, let's say you have three debts. We're going to say two of them are credit cards. One of them is an auto loan. You have $2,000 in credit card debt on credit A, $5,000 on credit card B, and you have a $3,000 auto loan. So in this scenario, you're going to focus on credit card A first, and then you're going to focus on that auto loan, and then you're going to focus on credit card B, because you're going to go from paying, focusing on $2,000 to the, and I'm already forgetting the numbers that I just said, $3,000 and then $5,000. But the point is you're stacking them from smallest debt to largest debt, because we're going to create a snowball. It's going to be easier to pay off that smaller debt first, and then you're going to get a win. Yay. Now, here are the two big things to remember. One, you are still always paying the minimum due on all of your debt. It's not like, oh, I'm going to press the pause button on all of my debt and take all of that money and put it towards one debt. Absolutely not. What you're going to do is look at your budget, or as people always like to say in my job, pick up a side hustle, pick up extra shifts, do whatever you have to do to make more money. But I'm going to say, if you can just look in your budget and figure out a place, even squeezing $10 out of somewhere to put towards your debt, that 10 extra dollars is going to be applied to the minimum payment on your debt or your debt snowball. So the smallest amount that you're paying, you're going to put that towards the minimum balance owed.
And then there's the avalanche.
So complicated. Avalanche is just, we're focusing on interest rates. So all it is, we actually really don't care what the principal balance is. We just care what the interest rates are. So oftentimes you're hitting credit card debts or credit cards first, because those often are coming with, as everyone knows, those 20%,
20 something. Yep.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Those are painful. So we're going to hit those first. And the reason that this is quote unquote the right way to pay down debt for a lot of people is because you're attacking this high interest rate debt first. It's going to take you longer to get that win, but it's going to save you more money over the debt payoff strategy. So we're just going to order our debts by highest interest rate to lowest interest rate and attack in that order. Again, like I mentioned earlier, there's no correct one. The correct one is the one that keeps you motivated to keep going. So if you're somebody who you need that layup, you need that easy win up front, go with snowball. If you're somebody who is motivated by like, hey, I'm going to keep as much money as I can from the people who are lending this to me and are gouging me with 27% interest rates, go with avalanche. As long as you get it done, it doesn't matter what the strategy is. And some people kind of create a hybrid model, to be honest.
Aaron Lowry, author of the Broke Millennial Personal Finance Book Series. Our latest one is called The Broke Millennial Workbook, as we discuss aspects of money management, paying down debt. You can call in with a question. You can add your experience, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A new report on household debt from the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. It cites a surge in credit card debt. As Jake in Milwaukee told us earlier, Americans now owe more than $1 trillion. Call in with a question about personal finance, 800-642-1234. Erin Lowry's new workbook in her Broke Millennial series is focused on taking control of money. Let's go to Nancy now in Milwaukee. Hi, Nancy.
Good morning. I would like to say that your guest is leaving out marketing, which plays a very large factor on how people either save or spend their money. For instance, a family may have a perfectly adequate refrigerator and perfectly adequate cell phones, but now a manufacturer puts out a refrigerator which will be able to send out an electronic signal telling you that you're out of eggs or that your milk is getting very low. But, of course, you have to have a different cell phone in order to take that electronic message. So a family will choose to throw out a perfectly respectable, adequate refrigerator and set of cell phones because the marketing division of a manufacturer has told them that they're out of date unless they have these latest appliances. So the family then is not only using up more of Earth's resources, they're putting themselves in deeper financial debt. That this marketing of appliances, cars, telephones, even the clothes you put on your body is to a large extent why people feel they have to have these things in order to say that they're living in a life economic style that befits them, that they deserve to have.
Nancy, thanks for bringing that to the table. Erin, you know, wanting the new shiny stuff, what is that impact of marketing?
You know, Nancy is absolutely correct. And then to top it all off, we have social media, which means that it's not even just traditional marketing, but influencers and just our peer group in general. And it's no longer just the items, whether it's the type of cell phone that you're using or the refrigerator or the car that's in your driveway, but the type of vacation that you're taking or where you're going out to eat or the concerts that you're attending. You know, we basically have just created this ecosystem partly for ourselves in which we feel constant pressure to keep up. And unfortunately, there is absolutely no easy solve for this. I'm with Nancy. I think use every appliance into the ground until you absolutely 100% need to get a new one, in large part because I agree with her about the waste element and constantly evaluating the ways in which we can be making sure that we're leaving the smallest footprint environmentally and living a more sustainable life, but also at the same time, monitoring our money. And oddly, there are times where it does make sense to upgrade, whether it's financially, it actually makes more sense for you. It might be something that's going to provide a certain amount of utility, but making sure that you're creating and making that decision for yourself because it's the accurate one and not because it's really good marketing that's telling you that.
Nancy, thank you for that call. It reminds me also of the conversation in your workbook about what to do when you can't afford a particular lifestyle thing, what that a friend is doing or asking you to do, and you kind of have this sandwich type conversation. Would you share that?
Absolutely. So one thing too, you know, I mentioned the social media part. I think a big thing that we need to acknowledge in these conversations is that as we age, and whether it's because of the salary that we earn or the lifestyle that we've elected, you know, maybe you got married, maybe you had kids before your friends did, you're probably living a different financial life. And it could mean there's more financial demands on you, or maybe you're a teacher and your friend from college ended up being an investment banker and you're making very different salaries. There are times, and I'll say the third thing would just be like, maybe your values are simply different. Your friend likes doing one thing and you like doing another thing, and you don't want to spend the money on the thing that your friend wants to do. Now, part of relationships, platonic, romantic, family, is investing into them, investing your time, sometimes investing your money. So you want to be careful about how you go around doing that. And one option is to utilize the compliment sandwich strategy when it comes to gently saying no. Instead of just saying no every time somebody asks you to do something because it's outside of your budget or you're saving for a big goal or because you simply don't value that thing, what you should do is start with, you know, I really want to spend time with you, or whatever your reason is up top. And then the gentle no, the, but I got to be honest, I just really do not want to spend $150 going to that concert or whatever the item is. But then for the closer, for that bottom piece of bread, give an alternative. Don't just say no and walk away from it. Say, but I would love to have you over for a game night, or I would love to get bagels and go for a walk, or I would love to go for a hike, or I would love to, you know, insert some activity that you like to do, particularly one that's financially within your means. And so that way, you know, you're not just constantly saying no, because truly, if you say no enough times, people stop asking. Hmm. You're still investing into your relationships, but you're also doing it kind of on your terms or within your means. And the final point here is it's also okay, even if you're paying off debt, to put a little bit of money aside every paycheck for a fun fund, so that sometimes you can just enthusiastically...
Like the Buffalo Bills Dream Fund?
Yes. So that is something, a little bit of a tease that I joke with my husband. My husband is a huge Buffalo Bills fan and, you know, famously went to the Super Bowl 4 times and didn't win. So his big dream is that one day he'll either get to go see them in the AFC Championship game and win, or go to the Super Bowl. So we set money aside every single month into a fund called the Bills Dream Fund, so that if and when that happens, we just have money set aside for him to go do that thing.
I really love that too, because, you know, you can do some dreaming with money, and it really, you can be creative with it. And I think that that really illustrates that in your approach to personal finance. Erin, in these short moments we have left, what is a cute strategy in renaming one of your accounts instead of, you know, X digits? Just a for instance here.
Well, a great example is the Bills Dream Fund. You know, most bank accounts just automatically say, you know, account number 5273X9 or whatever it is. Many banks and credit unions will allow you to actually rename that account. You can nickname your account. So therefore, when you log into your bank, it just says Bills Dream Fund, or it says, you know, big trip you want to take fund, or quit my job, summer 2024 fund, whatever it is that you want to do. It's just an extra bit of motivation. And also it discourages you from pulling a little bit out for a today treat when you're really trying to set your future self up.
Erin, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me back. Wonderful to be here.
Erin Lowry, author of the Broke Millennial Personal Finance Book Series. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.